Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2019. The first case on our calendar for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Todd Gunther. Counsel, I know you're both familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that you each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel Appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, and you may raise or lower the podium to meet your needs. So with that, Counsel for Appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Todd Alexander Gunther, in this matter. This case started with a warrantless search that was based on what we know now was a non-existent emergency. It ended with the execution of a mandatory minimum sentence that we know now no longer exists. Mr. Gunther is appealing both of those issues. On the Fourth Amendment point, it's hard to fault law enforcement for erring on the side of being more intrusive, which they were in this case. But the Constitution and this court is charged with erring on the side of protecting people's privacy interests from government intrusions. And I think the key to the intrusion in this case is the requirement that they be able to show objectively reasonable that there was imminent harm. Sometimes that's emphasized in the case law, but it's always there, is this imminent harm.
Now, counsel, you don't cite Reese versus State, which is the latest pronouncement from our Supreme Court about the emergency aid exception, but how does that case fit into the circumstances here?
I think that all of these cases are very fact-specific, and that there is no bright line governing law enforcement or really the courts when it comes to this. We do have a test, and it is very fact-specific.
But what are the facts here that should lead us to conclude that the district court erred?
In this case, it's that there was no allegation of the imminent injury. And, I mean, I break it down in my mind into three parts. There weren't any of the allegations you see in a lot of other cases. There weren't allegations of harm at all. There were no allegations of threats or assaults or anybody trying to interfere with a 911 call. It was just a noise complaint.
Screaming and yelling,
which, again, people have absolutely every right legally to argue. And that does not involve police involvement when it's in a private home. An argument on the street, yeah, but it's more protected in the home. And then you've actually got some dispelled suspicion when the police arrive. If they were thinking, sometimes arguments escalate into violence, either verbal violence or physical violence. There were no visible injuries whatsoever on Gunther. Nobody else called in to say that there was any sort of threat. There was no, to my knowledge, no prior history with this address. And so that should have dispelled any suspicions that were there, technically.
But when the officer arrived, as I understand the facts, they did overhear two voices in the apartment.
Correct.
And so the fact that one person came to the door and said, I'm fine, how does that dispel concern about the welfare of the other speaker?
Well, in terms of the hearing the two people, the fact is that the officers were able to hear two people not arguing. Assuming that the tip was accurate, that there was argument going on previously, or at least yelling and screaming, that was done. People were talking in normal tones of voice.
But now, that doesn't mean that that person didn't suffer any injury during that time.
Correct. But there's no evidence that they did. I mean, for every single situation, there could be the argument raised, yes, somebody could have been injured. But if we were to go that far, this exception literally doesn't require anything imminent. I mean, anytime there's a noise complaint, law enforcement have the right to enter the premise.
But why wasn't the call, yelling and screaming, officers hear two voices, he's reluctant to open the door, and when he does, he appears nervous and doesn't even open all the way, and basically lies to the officers and says, oh, there's nobody else here. I was talking to my girlfriend on the phone. So the officers know he's lying about another person being in there. He appears nervous. Why don't they have enough suspicion at that time to go forward and say, okay, we have to check out. We would be liable civilly if we didn't go forward to make sure the other person that we know is there is not in harm or not hurt or in danger.
Yeah, and it boils down to the fact that, in my mind, he was in his own home. He had that privacy right. I mean, I'm not completely sure that it's constitutional to force people to answer their door, according to the regulation in Burnsville, where you can actually strike and evict somebody for failure to answer their door after an unsubstantiated noise complaint. But, I mean, the facts here aren't perfect for Gunther, because he did lie, but he also had, you know, that right to not cooperate, to be in the safety of his own home. If there had been allegations that they thought that they had heard violence or had actually overheard a threat, like you get this all the time in these cases, I'll effing kill you, or screaming, or somebody get help. None of that was here.
In Reese, to be fair, Reese didn't involve any threats or yelling or real evidence of any violence. I mean, it was just the woman who lived there saw somebody she didn't know with a gun and was concerned because she had a baby in the house. But, I mean, there wasn't any threat of violence there either. That didn't make a difference to whether it was reasonable or that the officers had reasonable basis to check him and remove the gun from his person.
Yeah, it didn't make enough of a difference because, again, I think these cases can be weighed so many different ways. I don't want to say it made no difference. In the Yang case, the unpublished decision that we cited, there were allegations of rape, and it was held that that wasn't enough to show an imminent threat. Here, there were no allegations of guns or a baby in the house or anything like that. Again, it was just the arguing and yelling. I mean, and we know now, this doesn't matter for the legal analysis, but we know now that there was no physical anything. Like, the woman in the apartment didn't want to come to the door because there was a warrant for her arrest. She didn't want to talk to the police, and neither did Mr. Gunther. And they did say that he was acting nervous. His cat also did escape into the hallway. I've been in that situation where I only talk through the door a crack because I don't want my cat sneaking outside. So it's not that, I mean, I don't think that this, you could clearly fault law enforcement for what they did. But constitutionally, I don't think this rises to the level that supports a warrantless intrusion in this case. There wasn't that imminent harm. You have to make too many inferential leaps to get to the point where law enforcement could enter the privacy of somebody's residence.
Counsel, you've mentioned twice now that you really can't fault the officers for what they did, but there's actually case law that talks about how we also view it from the perspective of whether the officers would have been derelict in their duty. And it sounds to me like you're essentially conceding that they would have been derelict in their duty if they hadn't investigated further.
No, and I'm sorry if I gave that impression. Like, I don't think this would have been a dereliction of duty. I know
Why
the
not?
District court mentioned that. This certainly wouldn't have been a failure in training to say that law enforcement handled this inappropriately. Again, factually, we know no lawsuit ever would have come of this.
How do we know that?
Because to file that, it would have had to have either been the female in the home or Mr. Gunther himself. And they'd have no basis to say it was derelict for law enforcement not to come inside, discover their narcotics, and arrest her for an outstanding warrant.
Well, the dereliction would be if, in fact, the woman had been injured in you know, at the time of the screaming and yelling, and aid was not rendered and her injuries were more serious. I mean, that would be the claim.
Yeah, and in this case, we don't have those facts. So I was just saying,
sure,
like, facially on this case, there never would have been a lawsuit for dereliction of duty. But because we do have these protections to people in their privacy of their own homes, I don't see how a dereliction of duty case would get past a motion for dismissal on the pleadings because of just that. There needed to be more.
Whatever dereliction of duty case there might be, there's nobody goes damaged if they didn't go in.
In this case, exactly. But more importantly, like, if there was that one extra fact, if there was that allegation that somebody had called for help, or if the call had come from inside the house, or maybe even, I'm super speculating here, but maybe multiple calls from multiple people on both sides, above and below the apartment, or this apartment was known for having not only loud, boisterous parties, but fights, or if when they came up, they'd listened at the door, and they'd heard continued arguing, they'd heard a slap. I mean, again, these cases get so tied into their facts. But I know I do not think it would have been dereliction at all for law enforcement to have knocked and knocked and knocked and then left.
Do we know what time this occurred?
Going from memory, I believe.
I think it's 1 a.m.
It was in the evening, yes.
February 2nd, 1 a.m.
So in terms of close cases, I think this is far closer to being no, this was an unconstitutional intrusion. There needed to be more. People have the right to be, even be uncooperative in their own homes on the facts of this case. If the court weren't to rule in favor of Mr. Gunther on this case, I would also be arguing that the mandatory minimum did not apply to Mr. Gunther and that he should be resentenced without regard to the mandatory minimum given the stay of imposition of sentence. That's a situation where I openly admit we've got the same language from Otto on the statute.
That's what I was going to ask. How do we get around Otto and the ruling there that would seem to suggest that we look to how what the law was at the time the offense was committed?
The biggest distinction between this case and the Otto case is the fact that we're not dealing with current offenses and that we're looking at how we view prior offenses, which, you know, by definition are all going to have happened before the effective date of the statute. This is an argument where I've struggled with this a lot prepping for this argument. Sometimes I'm very glad I'm an advocate and I don't have to make these decisions because it's unjust. It's unjust to apply the mandatory minimum in this case. And as lawyers, we know that sometimes we've got different definitions of justice, but sometimes we have to do things. The district court struggled in this case with just that. But it is a distinction. I mean, it is looking at prior offenses that, had they been committed now, would not have been looked at the same way, would not have been defined the same way, and would not have invoked this mandatory minimum sentence for somebody who, by all accounts, absolutely, it's a waste of state resources to put him in prison. It may even set him back in terms of treatment.
But the legislature, we can agree, could have, if that's what they wanted the law to be, they could have written the law differently.
Correct.
So aren't we in the same position the district court was in? Even if we were to disagree with the outcome from it, this court said, I have to follow the law. Aren't we in the same situation?
If this court finds that the language that was interpreted in Otto and has been interpreted in the past did abrogate the amelioration doctrine, not only with respect to, you know, the weight thresholds, but also with respect to the definition of how prior offenses are used to calculate the mandatory minimum, then yes, Gunther loses on that issue, which is another reason why I really do, not another reason why, but I don't think it's as close as I've been implying in terms of the Fourth Amendment issue. I just think we need a couple extra facts for that to actually rise to the level of objectively imminent injury that would support the warrantless entry into a home. And that's why we're asking the court to both reverse the conviction based on the warrantless entry, suppressing all evidence that came after, and barring that, remand this matter for resentencing without regard to the mandatory minimum. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. My name is Chip Granger, and I'm the assistant Dakota County attorney representing the respondent in this matter. And I'm asking you to affirm both the district court's omnibus ruling and the sentencing order. The standard of review is that this court independently reviews the facts and determines as a matter of law whether the evidence needs to be suppressed. Because the facts are not significantly in dispute, this court analyzes the testimony of the officers and determines as a matter of law if the officers were justified under the cases in doing what they did. With respect to the statutory interpretation and the mandatory minimums, that the court reviews de novo. The emergency aid exception to the search warrant requirement justified Officer Lehman's and Officer Carlson's entry into the appellant's apartment without a search warrant to perform a caretaking function.
Okay, so that standard is, it has to be equivalent to probable cause, right?
Correct.
Okay, and because you're entering into somebody's home, into somebody's abode.
Correct.
So what happened here is they got a call saying there's yelling and screaming.
And swearing, I think, was part of it, too. Not a big deal, but that was an additional description.
Yelling, screaming, and swearing between a male and a female.
Correct.
They go there, they knock, they hear, one officer hears through the door a male and female voice, and they're talking. And there's no yelling and screaming. They ask, they knock, and they don't, the person doesn't open the door, the male doesn't open the door until they threaten, the police threaten a strike against them. The person opens the door, they say, they converse a little bit, and he acknowledges that, he just says that he was talking on the phone to somebody else because they say, we heard a male and female voice. He said, he lies to them, says, no, I was on the phone talking to my girlfriend. They asked to inspect and see if somebody else is there. And then what they do is then the cat gets out and then the doors open a little bit more and then they push the door open and they pull him out of his residence, of his home, right?
Correct.
They cuff him and they put him in the hallway. And then they ask if somebody else is in there. And, okay, so those facts essentially aren't in dispute. And then they eventually find her. She's locked in the bathroom.
Correct.
Okay. How is this different than, well, I have several concerns here. First of all, basically it's a yelling, screaming, and swearing that they're relying on, correct?
Correct.
Okay. How is that a sign that the police can rely on of imminent harm to a person?
Because they're relying on that, and then I think you couple that with the appellant telling them that no one else is in the apartment, and yet they've just heard the female voice in there. It's like, why is he lying that there's not someone else in there if everything's okay?
Right, but all they heard was a male and female voice talking. They don't even hear the yelling and screaming.
Correct.
And screaming anymore.
Correct. It was the reporting party who heard the yelling and the screaming and the disturbance.
Okay, did they see any signs of physical harm to appellant?
Nope.
Did they see any, like, injuries, rashes, red marks, cuts to his hand, anything?
No visible signs of injury, no.
Okay, did they see any signs of that there may have been things thrown around in the apartment or the door, you know, holes in the door, anything like that?
They're not able to see into the apartment at that point because the appellant standing in the doorway kind of sticking his head partway out, which was, I think, another reason that led them to their suspicions, the way he's just partially opened the door, sticking his body out. And
does he have any requirement to open the door completely for police and say, hey, look around, it's my home, but no big deal?
I don't know that there's a requirement, but the way that he was doing it made them suspicious that something had happened to that
person.
Okay,
made them suspicious, but the perspective is an objective point of view, not a subjective what they thought.
Right. I think what an objective police officer would think. Would a police officer think that there's a harm or something to that person? They've received the report of the yelling and the screaming. It takes them a while to answer the door. It's what is he doing in between, you know, that time?
So I realize that the cases are very fact specific, but is there any case law indicating that yelling, screaming, and swearing is enough to justify entry into somebody's home? And that is enough to support a probable cause determination that somebody is in imminent harm of danger.
I don't think there's a whole lot of case law out there on this issue, and I didn't find any that said there is. I didn't find any that said there isn't. It's all very fact-specific, but I couldn't find anything one way or the other when I was working on the brief.
Okay, so let's change this slightly. I usually don't like to get into hypotheticals,
all right,
but I'm going to in this
all
situation.
Right.
I'm at home, okay? It's purely hypothetical that my wife and I are yelling, screaming, and swearing at each other. We've never done that before. This is purely hypothetical. Okay?
I believe you.
I'm glad you believe me. And the neighbors hear this yelling and screaming, so they call the police. It's 1 a.m. in the morning. It's past 10 o'clock. You're supposed to be quiet after 10, right? So they call the police and say, hey, neighbors are, they're yelling and screaming and swearing at each other. Can you go check out to see what's going on? So they come to my home, okay? They knock on the door, and I'm just like, I don't want anybody to disturb me at this time. I'm in my home. I'm in my refuge. They keep knocking, and they say, if you don't answer the door, we're going to knock down the door. So finally, okay, reluctantly, I go open up the door. I just open up a crack. Okay, officers, what do you want? We just want to make sure everybody's okay. Everybody's okay. Just leave. No, well, we want to check to see. Well, no, this is my home. Everything's okay. I just told you. Don't worry about it. And then they go to proceed to pull me out of my home, handcuff me, sit me down on my front step, and then proceed to do a search of my house. How is that justified under the Fourth Amendment?
I don't think that's quite as strong of a justification there, because you didn't lie to the officers about your wife not being there.
What if I told them, hey, my wife isn't even here. She's on vacation. I don't want them disturbing me, and they're bothering me at 1 a.m. in the morning.
If the officers had some reason to believe that your wife was in there, then I would think they would have.
What belief would they have? Because all they heard was us talking. They didn't hear any yelling and screaming when they arrived at my house.
Right, and if that's the case, then no, there wouldn't be. But in this case, they heard the female voice in the apartment.
Let's assume they heard my voice and my wife's voice, the two of us talking, no longer yelling, screaming, or swearing, and they, in the exact same situation. Let's assume that they heard that through the door. So they know my wife is there, and I lie to them. I tell them, hey, she's not here, she's on vacation.
Then I would think they would be justified in coming.
Pull me out of my house, handcuff me, and go search my house without a warrant and without my permission.
To check on your wife's safety, yes, because I can see where they would be concerned.
But what evidence do they have to show that she's in imminent danger of harm based on yelling and screaming and swearing that occurred prior to their arrival?
Well, they can see where that would, she can maybe be injured from that yelling and screaming. You're saying she's not there. The officers heard that she was there. It's like, why are you lying to the officers that she's not there if everything's okay?
Because I don't want the officers there. I want them to leave. I want them to go.
But they don't know if that's the case or if your wife's badly injured, maybe laying in the other room dead or dying.
Right, but what evidence do they have to support that probable cause determination that she may be injured or harmed in some way?
Just the report that they received originally.
Yelling and screaming and swearing.
And okay. So they had heard that loud noise, then you're telling them that she's not in there. They've heard the voice, so they know that she's in there. So it's like, why isn't he being forthright with us, you know, if there's not a problem with her? And that's when I think they can be justified in going in to check on her safety so they don't end up getting sued.
Why do we keep assuming that the report of yelling and screaming and swearing was accurate if the police get there and there's no such thing going on?
Because it doesn't need to be continuous yelling or screaming. And the officers heard somebody in there.
But that should be like the fix. Once that report is made, then the officers should just assume that that's got to be true. And anything that's inconsistent with that is a problem requiring further examination.
Right. I think they need to investigate that to find out, was there really yelling and screaming going on and why?
But it does kind of seem like they did. They sat at the door and they had to put their ears against the door to hear people apparently talking in normal voices.
Correct. There wasn't yelling and screaming going on when the officers were there.
Some evidence to suggest that maybe some nosy neighbor was making too much of something earlier.
It's that, to me, is the job of the police, to go out there and investigate. Was there yelling and screaming going on? Was there a violent situation? Or was it peaceful? Is everybody inside of that apartment okay? And that's why they listened to try.
Heard a female voice talking, right?
Correct.
Not moaning.
Correct.
Not screaming. Not gasping, but talking.
Correct. But then why is the male who answered the door denying that she's even in there if everything...
Do you have any obligation to tell police if he has a visitor over, and if so, who it is?
I think if the police get a report that there's yelling and screaming and swearing going on in this apartment, and they can hear the voice so they know she's still in there, they go to check on it, and somebody lies to them and says, no, that person's not in here, I think that does justify their entry to check out and find out what's going on. Is that other person okay? Why is this person denying? There may be nothing wrong with them. There may be something
wrong. A lot of reasons at 1 in the morning that one doesn't say exactly why, who's in the house and why.
And that's what the police need to investigate. That's meeting that probable cause standard.
I have a question that has to do with the statements that the officers made to the appellant here. I mean, it seems to me the officer's expressed concern was for the welfare of a potential female in that apartment. So why did they tell the appellant when he said, no, you can't come in here, that what they were going to do was file a strike? As I understand the filing of the strike, that is just notifying the city that they wouldn't let him in, and if you get 3 strikes, you get evicted. I mean, why would you say that as opposed to just say, we're coming in anyway because we're concerned that somebody is hurt in the apartment?
I don't think it's notifying the city. I think it's notifying the apartment.
Okay, but in any event, that wouldn't suggest a sense of urgency, or that somebody, in my mind at least, that somebody is in need of emergency aid if the response to, no, you can't come in, is, okay, we'll file a strike.
And
why am I wrong?
I don't know that you're wrong. I think it was an attempt to get into the apartment so they could check it out and see if everything was okay. Had he not opened the door to the apartment in response to him saying, if you don't open it, you know, there's going to be a strike, they may have gone and gotten the apartment manager to get a key to open it. I know they do that sometimes when they're doing search warrants on apartments. They get the key from the apartment manager. They could have gotten a ram to break the door to get in to check and see if she's okay. So I'd say it was one in an arsenal of things to try to get into the apartment that, had he ignored it and figured, fine, I'll take the strike, I don't know that that would have put an end to it at that point.
Was there any evidence in the record of prior calls to this apartment?
I don't believe so.
Was there any evidence in the record of any domestic assault allegations or charges involving the parties here?
Not that I recall, no. I don't believe there is.
Okay.
Then with respect to the mandatory minimum 24-month prison sentence, the state believes that State versus Lynch makes it clear that the mandatory minimum 24-month prison sentence still does apply, and it's not retroactively reduced with the change in the statute, that the court was correct in interpreting the statute as she was still required to impose the mandatory 24-month prison sentence. And then in conclusion, asking that you affirm both the district court's omnibus order and the sentencing order, and then I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kohler, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. To my understanding, there's no published case law regarding the specific sentencing issue raised in this case. That's why I'm asking this court to remand for sentencing without regard to the mandatory minimum. With respect to the Fourth Amendment issue, I do think that any suspicion that could have existed as a result of this tip was dispelled when law enforcement arrived at the door, and that anything after that was an unwarranted expansion of and lead into a warrantless search and seizure.
And that is because the officers didn't hear the screaming and yelling that had been reported?
Correct. Like, assuming there had been an argument at that point, if anything, it had concluded.
Someone could be dead inside the apartment or dying. I mean, that would be a reason why the argument screaming wasn't going on.
And the female from the apartment, you know, could have had a stroke. I mean, There's thousands of exceptions or extrapolations that law enforcement could jump to, and I mean, they're trained to think the worst and to always make those jumps. And that's why these cases are so fact-intensive,
Is there any evidence here that the officers were motivated by anything other than checking on the welfare of the female occupant or who they believed to be still in the apartment?
That's ridiculously hard to prove. There is no evidence that I'm aware of that they had an ulterior motive, and I think that's another reason why the standard is purely objective.
Right, so I mean, this wasn't a drug apartment, or you know, they didn't. It wasn't. There hadn't been prior calls to this unit or anything like that would suggest another reason to be there.
No. I would categorize it as whimsical or capricious. The standard for a Terry stop that would be unconstitutional. I don't think they had enough to jump to those conclusions on these facts,
so
they were just looking. Is what it was.
And the district court seems to have credited the videos and the testimony that they didn't go in there and start rummaging through stuff. They were actually looking for the woman.
And I think that they were.
Right.
I mean, they stood outside the door for minutes yelling. They jumped to I don't know if they explicitly stated it, but I think the assumption is that they assumed that even though they had heard her talking minutes earlier, she was so injured that she couldn't respond to their calls because they waited outside the door yelling for several minutes before they went in, found her in the locked bathroom, threatened to break the door down, pulled her out, and arrested her.
Right, but what I'm asking, I guess, it seems like the district court credited the testimony that they really did once they got in there. They just looked for her and saw the other stuff in passing.
I don't know if crediting that was even necessary. I think a lot of what they saw in plain view was readily apparent almost as soon as they came in.
Right, on their way to finding her.
Yes. And so I am asking the court to find that this was an unconstitutional intrusion. A warrant should have been obtained or the search should not have happened. This was more of an investigation than any sort of actual attempt to stop imminent harm or injury. And on that ground, we're asking to reverse as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.